You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. Matthew 5, 21 to 22.
You're listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we delve into the lectionary readings to help you preach the Word of God. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. And today we are joined by Reverend Emeritus Professor William Loader. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
Today we're focusing on the text from Epiphany 6, Matthew 5, 21 to 37.
And this is our third week of being in Matthew 5. We've spent, for those of you who've been following the lectionary or regularly in church, this is we've been well into the Sermon on the Mount now, and following Jesus' teaching there with the Beatitudes and some statements about the law. And this week we're really going to delve even more deeply into some of those.
Now, Bill, today's lectionary reading contains quite a meaty meal. Mm-hmm. We have anger, adultery, divorce, oaths, and going to hell. I'm wondering where you might suggest one would focus as a preacher with all of those hot themes.
Well, you know, unless you're going to have a very long sermon, you will need to make some choices. You also need to be sensitive pastorally to a number of problems which are present in this passage, which I think you need to address, even if it's in a minor part of your sermon. And they include anger, because many people have read this passage's meaning, I should never be angry. Mm. And I want to talk about that at some stage. You should also address the issue of sexuality, because you can read this passage as saying if you have a sexual response, it's male discourse, to a woman, the same would be the other way, you have sinned. Mm-hmm. And there will be people in your congregation maybe who've been through a divorce. Mm. So there are really sensitive issues in this passage that need to be addressed.
So our work today is to try and get to perhaps the ethical teaching that underlies this without perhaps oversimplifying it or just simply focusing on the word of, and there is a word of judgment here. There's a threat of punishment for those who are not on this path. We could start with any one of these, but perhaps let's start with the anger you've named and this pairing that Jesus does here. We go from murder, you've heard it said, but I say, and we move from murder to anger. Can you unpack that for us, Bill? What's going on here, and is Jesus changing the law, upping the ante on the law? What's he doing?
He's really just doing good Judaism. He's really doing what is already in the tradition. You've got passages in Proverbs, for instance, that talk about hate and anger, and he's taking the law. Mm. We know it from the Ten Commandments. It's interesting that it's the ethical law he's focusing on as important, and he's saying, you know, you've heard how that's been understood in the past. Let me tell you what it really means. It also means this. Mm. And we need to be careful in interpreting this because, of course, Matthew assumes Jesus gets angry, as do the other Gospels. So it's not being angry. It's holding anger against. It's really hating. Mm. Hateful attitudes towards anyone really are killing. They are murderous. They are not loving your enemy. One of the interesting things about this whole passage, it goes on beyond the reading that we have, is that it begins and ends with an emphasis on love and you don't hate. So mm. it ends with love your enemies and it begins with don't hate. Don't. Yes. Now, what people do with anger is really scary because if I'm not allowed to be angry, then I'll keep it in myself. And that means I'll redirect the anger to myself, which is a good way of making yourself sad.
Yes.
Or I'll keep it to myself until it blows up and then it really hurts me or hurts you. So anger management is a key theme, and Matthew says quite a lot about anger management. He goes on to say, look, if you've got somebody who's got something against you, go and talk to them. Talk it out. Don't sit on your anger because it's actually destructive.
That's such an important distinction, the difference between we're all going to feel angry at times, and in fact I think in the Bible there's a very clear permission to for righteous anger. We should get angry at certain things, but that's different to that abiding hatred that leads to such destruction.
Anger is always, nearly always, a second feeling. Before anger, there's hurt or there's some negative experience, and we respond to that with anger. Mm. Now, anger is something that's fairly spontaneous, so it's a little bit like hunger and thirst and sexual feelings, and the key thing is what you do with them.
Yep.
They are in themselves neutral. It's okay to feel hungry. It's okay to feel thirsty, but you go out and get drunk or you go out and eat too much and you know what the consequences are. They're even more significant if you act on anger like that.
It's also true, too, that anger is the result of a sense of righteousness or your idea of justice. So I'm thinking of Cain and Abel, Cain slaying Abel.
And Jesus getting angry in the temple and... I mean, I would say that to me is good anger or righteous anger as opposed to, the
to
kind
Cain
of anger
Abel,
that comes out of hurt and pain. And
so he was not reconciled to God, really. That was the root of his anger.
I think anger is ethically neutral. Anger is always okay. It's how anger that is expressed, how it is held, that's the poisonous element in it. Mm. The same as with food, the same as with thirst, the same as with sexual feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, my mind's just spinning here with all the sort of – this just seems so applicable in our contemporary era without, you know, getting into it too much. But we're seeing, you know, such polarizing views in public discourse, in online behavior.
Outrage.
Which to me would all fall into that category of actually hateful behaviour and vindictive behaviour and the kind of anger that wants to tear others down. I don't think we have to look too far for examples of that destruction.
And this is a very important thing because, you can talk about righteous anger, but if it means polarisation, if it means that you are now hating the oppressor, if you're now hating the enemy, you've actually departed from the way of Jesus.
Yes.
So if you're if you are a progressive angry person, angry, you know, and hating people, that's not helpful. We do get angry about the fact that climate change is not being addressed by a government. If you then turn that into a splitting off, a polarization where you write off politicians, where you write off people who've got the opposite opinion. So you can be destructive and hateful as a person who's forwarding a progressive approach just as much as you can be destructive when you're trying to promote a conservative approach. There's no place for hatefulness in public discourse and in human relations, according to the model of Jesus.
That's right, which is why verse 23, I think, is so important. In between these pairs we have of the murder and anger and adultery and lust, which we'll move to in a moment, these couple of verses about, you know, don't come to the altar, basically. Don't bring your gifts in worship until you've done that work of human reconciliation. We can't be reconciled with God while we actually live in a state of hatred towards one another.
I think it's Matthew 18 where he also gives a lot more detail about practicing reconciliation.
Yeah.
Go and sort it out. I mean, in Matthew 18, it's about when somebody else has done wrong. Mm. In this passage, it's actually where somebody holds something against you. Mm-hmm. But in all things, you never write people off. Mm. That's the key message, really.
Well, should we go to the next big one? Adultery and lust. What do you do with that, Bill?
It really depends on how you translate that particular saying. It can mean, if you look at a woman, and it's a male discourse, it's the way it's framed, if you look at a woman in order to have sexual response to her, you have committed adultery with her already in your heart. You can also translate it as if you look at a woman with the result that you have a sexual response to her, that means something different. Now, the second has been the way it has sometimes been read. In other words, if a man looks at a woman and has a sexual response, he has committed adultery. Now, when you look at it like that, that really is saying a sexual response is a sinful thing. Mm. And so men feel terribly guilty about their sexuality because they're having a sexual response towards women. My sexual feelings are bad. And that has plagued the church down through the centuries. It's also had a secondary effect. That means that for men, women are dangerous because they can make me have a feeling that makes me sinful. So that is really serious. And that means we men need to control women because women are dangerous.
Yeah, that ties into a much wider discourse around women covering up and being modest and then the onus being put on women not to provoke such a response. So you're saying obviously that's not how you would read it. You would read this, what the word is pros in the Greek, this sort of with the, you know, with the desire to or towards desiring as somehow an intention of sexualizing a woman.
What I try to do is to be very strict with myself and not try to read what I think would be comfortable for me and for other people.
Fair enough.
So I look at the way pros, this Greek word, is used, this expression in the rest of Matthew. Matthew uses it not to mean with the result that, but to mean for the purpose of. Mm. So the first interpretation, the first translation I gave is almost certainly the correct one. Mm. So what Jesus is saying is if you look at someone else's wife, because the word here is not just any woman, it's a wife. If you look at somebody else's wife and you want to commit adultery with them, then you have in effect committed adultery in your mind. Now, what is actually happening here is that the 10th commandment, you shall not covet, desire, lust after, is being applied to the earlier commandment about not committing adultery.
That's right.
Now, it's really important to see that. And then Matthew, of course, collects around this some other sayings which really say men, and it's addressing men, but you could apply it also just as much to women. When you have sexual feelings, control yourself.
Yes.
Take responsibility for the way in which you express your sexuality in the same way that you take responsibility for the way in which you direct your anger in the previous section. So Matthew will later go on to say, so don't exploit children sexually and take it so seriously that Jesus uses these exaggerated statements, cut your hand off, pull your eyes out, cut your legs off, you know, take sexual exploitation, whether you're a man or a woman, take that very seriously. And of course, it's taken a long time for the church to really do that. And we've been facing those issues in recent times.
I mean, Jesus, to me, Jesus' exaggeration here is really also an expression of how strong those feelings are, how real they are, how part of being human they are.
Especially when he talks later in Matthew 18 about one of these little ones, which I think originally, though it came to be referred mainly to Christian young children, but originally it was probably just little ones. So if you cause one of these little ones to stumble, and the word stumble is used in sexual contexts, then you really need to have a millstone around your head and be cast into the depths of the sea. Wow, what's so big about this? Well, it's a big issue. Sexual exploitation of children, but sexual exploitation of anyone, whether it's rape or whether it's in marriage or whether it's in church, wherever it happens, it has no place because it's the opposite of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we come to our third large theme, divorce, where Matthew seems to have a very hard line here. Can you give us some context of the nature of divorce or perhaps even the prevalence, if you can talk about that, in Matthew's time?
Well, let me go back a bit further, and that is back in the time of the patriarchs, in fact, up until fairly close to the time of Jesus, the pattern was that you could have more than one wife, you know, polygyny, technically. And so if you had conflict within a marriage, instead of divorcing, you wouldn't do that, you'd simply get another wife. And later on, you might fall in love with that first wife. Again, that was certainly possible. Under Greek and Roman influence in particular, they began to set aside this idea that you could have polygamy or polygyny. So you, when that was taken up as the value, then what could you do? Well, you couldn't take another wife. You actually had to divorce her. On what grounds could you divorce a wife? It was all male discourse mainly. Mm-hmm. A woman could initiate divorce as well. But on what grounds could you do so? Well, some of the flippant answers were, well, if the cooking's not good, or if some, you know, menial task is not fulfilled properly. So this was quite a controversy. And at the time of Jesus, it's very likely that we are dealing with historical material here, where people come to Jesus and say, well, so what do you think about it? And Jesus says, God never meant it to happen anyway. God meant two people to come together and for that to last. Mm. So Jesus made statements about, well, if you do that, if God's joined them, don't unjoin them. You can't do that. And, of course, that means that any remarriage would be adultery because the relationship has continued to exist. Now, Matthew, only Matthew has Jesus say, except for, now the word probably means adultery. And this reflects the what had become true in Judaism and also in the Greco-Roman world. Because once the Romans forbade Jews to kill people when they committed adultery, the only option then was to have a divorce. So adultery was understood as actually terminating the marriage. Mm. You know that.
Oh, right.
So that's why they all assumed that, of course, adultery mandated divorce.
Yeah, that was the breaking of the marriage had already happened in the act of adultery.
The German word is Ehebruch. It breaks the marriage. Mm-hmm. So that's why Matthew's exception is not sort of mollifying what Jesus said originally. It's simply spelling out what everybody understood. But, of course, then what happened in time was that people said, well, are we to use Jesus' statement as a permanent law, or should we interpret Jesus' statement in the light of his broader concern about love and reconciliation? And so in situations where there had been violence in a marriage, obviously it was right for that to be terminated, for that to, and quite often the more caring and loving thing is for the relationship to cease and for things to begin again. But of course, also the gospel has taught us that adultery does not have to end a marriage. And again, the gospel helps us to say that actually sometimes reconciliation is possible. So our attitude to divorce and marriage is very different from the ancient world and the first Christians. They believed that adultery ended the marriage. We would say, no, no, it needn't end the marriage. Lots of other things might end the marriage that don't involve adultery. Mm-hmm. So we have a, you know, a more nuanced approach, which I don't think is watering things down. It's actually deepening things and saying it's always got to be love that dictates how we respond to human situations, and we should take that very strictly.
I was reading Stanley Hauerwas's commentary in the Bratzos series on this passage, and he talks a lot about the nature of this being about the nature of the Christian community, what it is called to be, and that if Christians don't have to marry, if women who've been abandoned don't have to remarry, then that means the church has got to be a community of friendship, and that is an alternative to the loneliness out there. So that actually what's happening here is a real call to the community to be love-filled. I don't know what comment you might make about that reading.
Yes, I think that one of the problems for women who were divorced is that they would have really three main options. One would be to return to their original families, and many of them did that. Mm. The second would be to marry again. That would be the normal thing. Most people were married. That could be problematic. Another would be to engage in being an independent person, which might lead some into prostitution. It needn't do that. But there is also within this strictness about divorce and remarriage, there is a concern for women, and I think that's present. And so that has to do also with being a community where there's a place for people who are struggling with broken relationships or whatever.
Or vulnerability.
Yeah. You know. One of the interpretations I do find fairly convincing is, I mean, as you've alluded to, Bill, the ancient, you know, entire construction of marriage was so very different to our own. We're talking arranged marriages. We're talking a fairly significant age gap often between a young, early teenage girl and a much older man. You know, a whole lot of things. The family's involved. It brings shame on the family if that marriage breaks down. And, you know, I find it fairly convincing here that, you know, Jesus is talking to other men, so it makes some sense that he's talking about divorcing a wife. But it's also saying that that arbitrary discarding of a wife, maybe because you saw a better option or you didn't like her food or what, you know, we're trivializing it somewhat, but that you can't actually simply get rid of a wife except in this case on the grounds of adultery, according to Matthew, is a way to protect women from the vulnerability that divorce might have left them in. You know, when opportunities to work and live independently, as in our modern age, are, you know, it's just such a different setting.
Yeah, it really would have made it, you know, hugely problematic for women. And and you're right, yes, that the difference in age, most people were married and most men were twice the age of the people they married. And so men drew the conclusion that because their partners were less mature and less experienced, that therefore women were inferior.
Yep.
So men called the shots, men controlled women, genealogies were constructed on the basis that it all comes through the man.
Yes.
It was all very male-dominated. And while Jesus raised issues that really underlined that every person matters, women and men equally, it took a long time for that to be thought through and for the implications to be thought through in terms of how we relate to men and how we relate to women. We haven't finished that process. No. There are still assumptions that men hold, and there are crises that men have when they realize that actually women can do things equally as well as them.
Or better.
And we're dealing with that today.
Yeah, that's right. I want to switch gears here for a moment before we sort of return to the, you know, we've been talking about a number of themes that could be preached and, you know, before we wrap this all up. But in the midst of this teaching and this sort of almost higher ethical obligation that lies behind the law is a threat of punishment. And the language in the NRSV at least is of hellfire or hell, this word that I think needs a bit of unpacking. In the Greek, it's Gehenna, which is probably from an Aramaic referring to a valley, the valley of Hinnom, which is south, maybe southwest of Jerusalem. And, you know, the tradition is that this was a place associated with fire, and we have references in Jeremiah about child sacrifice happening in this place. So it was associated with those the high places where children were sacrificed to Baal. There's actually quite a lot of reference to child sacrifice in the Old Testament, and it's always condemned. The God Yahweh does not require child sacrifice like some of the neighbouring religions do. But having said all of that, I can explain what the word means and that this is a threat of Gehenna. So it's a threat, it's metaphorical, I think, of going to this fiery place associated with such evil and wickedness. But there's still a question what we do with the threat of punishment. Even if we say it's a metaphor for the worst place you can imagine on earth, what do we do with Matthew's threat of punishment here? That there's serious consequences for breaking this ethical obligation we have.
This is Matthew's world, and it was the world of the time, and the expectation was that there would have to be a sorting out of the injustices in this world, and God would in the future at some stage sort them out.
Mm.
Now, you can hear that cry. I think you can have sympathy with it. And there would be many people who would say, in this life it's unfair, and that's got to be balanced. And so how are you going to balance it? Well, there's going to be a balancing act, and God will make up for it, you know.
Mm.
Or how can this person who's been doing these terrible things get away with it? Now, earlier theology said, well, they won't because they'll get sick, but they didn't.
No.
So the evil, the wicked triumph. So then what developed in Judaism and Christianity took it over was the notion that, well, there's going to be a day of reckoning where it will be sorted out and everything will be made fair.
Mm.
You can take that then and turn it into a weapon for threatening and warning people. And I can remember preaching that was really based on Jesus came to warn you that you will go to hell and suffer all that burning sulfur pain, and so accept Jesus. And I can remember my minister saying to me, when I thought this was the way he ought to preach, I can remember him saying to me, but this is really not the way it works. This really misses something. And so it's there. This understanding is there. People are going to have to be present at the judgment day, so they're going to have to be raised from the dead. That's where resurrection comes from. Okay, I mean, I think we need to hear the cry that there must be justice, and we leave that in the hands of God. But when we come to look at Jesus' actual ministry, and I don't think we should deny that he would have been part of this world and part of this expectation as well, that it would happen soon in his lifetime. His focus was not to go around telling people, you'd better change, otherwise you'll be done. But rather he went out to actually invite people into a relationship with love, who offer people forgiveness, offer people acceptance, and do it on the basis that this is actually what's going to change. This is actually the good news. And I think if we focus on that, then the other will, you know, have its place. I think myself that the notion that some people perpetuate, and I think you could find Bible verses to support it, of course, especially in Matthew, the notion that God will one day cease to love and permanently torture people is gross. It's a human projection of the very worst kind.
Of the anger we were talking
and,
about earlier.
Desire for vengeance that we carry within us.
It's violent. So people will have difficulties with this. And I think that we need to respect that we're not saying that love means saying everything's okay. Love is actually very confronting. I may hate love because it looks at me and sees the truth and I don't want to see it.
And so demands something of you.
So we're not talking about, you know, fluffing around with something that, you know, let's just water it all down. But we are needing to address the fact that this emphasis on God being non-loving in the end and violent is a very, very dangerous notion and leads, of course, to men concluding that when they are right, they can be violent too. So there will be a correlation between those who advocate this kind of understanding of God and the degree of domestic violence in those communities. That's something that's quite dangerous, and it's good that we've been addressing that. If you're going to hold to that understanding and leave it open, God will judge, fine. But if you're going to focus, make that the center of your ministry or the center of your preaching, you're doing something that's quite dangerous and that's really not the center of Jesus' preaching, and you're a bit out of step.
Yeah, no, that's right. Thank you, Bill. There's so many big issues here, and we could probably talk for hours about this, but we won't for the sake of our listeners. If you haven't listened to our special pre-episode that we recorded back in November with Bill Loader, where we unpacked a number of the themes and theology of Matthew, we talked there a bit more about the law and what we do with it, and that might be some further helpful background for you who are preaching on this text and trying to make sense of what's going on, particularly in this passage of Matthew 5 and this Sermon on the Mount. So, Bill Loader, thank you so much for being with us, for sharing just a little bit of your insights into what Matthew's doing and the Jesus movement. We can't thank you enough.
Thank you. It's been good to be with you.
It's been great. Thanks.
You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate and share it, or look for further resources on our website, bythewell.com.au.
This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, the Uniting Church in Australia, and the technical wizardry of Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.